We're talking now with Scott Herndon. He is a candidate for the District 1 Senate seat in the Idaho Legislature. And Scott, thank you for taking time to speak with us today.
It's my pleasure, Chris. Glad to have an opportunity to talk to your listeners today.
Well, I always like to start out with, tell us a bit about yourself, your background, what you consider to be qualifications for being a legislator in your professional background, and we'll circle around to why are you running?
Okay, so my wife Arlene and I have lived in Sandpoint area. We live in Sagal now for the last 22 years, since 2004. We came when it was a lot more affordable and when it was a lot smaller and before a lot of other people have come since then. And we've raised 8 children here, most of whom are adults now. I have a degree in finance and used to work in accounting and finance and big systems implementation for large companies. And when I moved here, we built our own house, and I literally did it by myself with one or two other people every now and then. That was 22 years ago, and then I got into custom home building because I had a friend call and ask me about building his house. So now I employ 3 other guys, and that's what we do for a living. And I've been in the Senate in 2023 and 2024. Honestly, I was probably one of the most effective senators that's been there. I got a lot of bills passed for people in District 1 up at Priest Lake, down here next to Lake Pondere, literally local issues that needed solving, and I was able to navigate the process and get typically about 10 bills passed a year, which I know a lot of people sounds like, well, that's too much legislation, but sometimes it's very practical issues. We stopped the Priest Lake siphon. We fixed a dock issue with IDL that had to be a statutory change and things of that nature. So that's my background and my qualifications for being in the legislature. The finance background fit in really well with being on the Senate Finance Committee. So I was very effective there in changing our budgeting process. And so that's a little bit about me.
Well, great. That begs the question, why are you running for re-election?
So I honestly think that right now a lot of District 1 people are not being well represented in the Senate at the moment, particularly on some of our budget issues, on some of our spending issues at the state level. We're facing tremendous uncertainty about affordability in the area, jobs, the economy, taxes, and regulations. And I think there's a lot more that we can do in that regard. I've looked at the current senator, and I don't think he's in sync on a number of key issues. Those, and then we see differences, and we may talk about later in this interview about the bathroom safety bill that passed this year based on an issue here in Sandpoint at the YMCA, but even on public lands issues. I know in previous campaigns it's been alleged that I didn't support public land access, and I actually have a great record on the Priest Lake siphon and on access to Lake Pondere at Camp Bay, and that included public lands and waters. And then our senator last year voted for a new Idaho crime that would criminalize access to public lands. So there's just a number of issues where we're totally different, and I actually think a lot of District 1 voters are not being well represented.
Okay, well, let's turn that into what do you think are a few specific issues that will come up, I'd say, in the next legislative session or two that you identify as key issues for our voters here in District 1?
Well, number one are the tax and spend issues. So last year we had an opportunity to cut income taxes again by $253 million, lowering our flat tax rate. We obviously see gas prices now with our United States action in Iran that are over $4. And people are really facing an affordability crisis. I talked to a couple this past weekend in Priest River. They're both electricians. Their mortgage is $3,200 a month, and they're not able to get ahead. And he's actually, even though he's a very well-trained electrician and runs his own business, he's thinking about making a career change. And there are a few things we can do at the state legislature to help that. And one of those is to control state spending so we don't create inflation and our economy. And the other one, and it's my plan to eliminate property taxes, would lower some of their monthly costs. So government should get out of the way of business, and we shouldn't regulate business too heavily so that it increases costs, and we shouldn't do things that increase the cost of everyday prices on food. And that's another example. There were some votes last year that would actually increase the cost on food that I would have voted no for, and our current senator voted yes. But I think the big issues are going to be around tax and spending. There's a lot of room that we can maneuver in the next legislative session. Even though there were talks of budget cuts this year, we actually grew state spending, but we have a lot of areas we need to pay attention to that are eating into the budget.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to dig in on the idea of eliminating property taxes. It just seems like math. If you take away that revenue source, it's going to have to either be replaced by another revenue source, or you have to cut a lot of services. And a lot of property taxes, I think almost all of them, go to local services. So how does that work?
Okay, so let's talk about the total government picture. In Idaho, I'm going to use simple numbers, so it's nice round numbers. $14 billion is the state budget, and $2 billion is the total cost of all local governments. So if the total cost of government is $16 billion, then one out of eight of those dollars funds local government. That's paid for by property taxes currently. Now, in 2023, we passed House Bill 292, overrode the governor's veto. People see it on their property tax bill this year as the homeowner tax reduction. So we redirected state revenues, which are mostly income taxes and sales taxes, to pay for local governmental costs. And that pays every year 5 to 10% of your homeowner's property tax bill. And we could literally keep doing that until we paid for 100% of your property tax bill. And the way to do that is you control state spending. So we've grown state spending by $600 per person above inflation and population growth just in the last 6 years. Well, with 2 million Idahoans, $600 per person, that's $1.2 billion. Had we just kept state spending at inflation and population growth, we could pay half your property tax bill right now. Local services would still be funded. Local control would still be local. And you would have less of a property tax bill.
Okay, well, let's take a look at what they did this year on tax and spending, specifically spending, because the state was facing a budget shortfall, has been facing that. And the legislature and Governor Little enacted a series of bills for budget cuts that reduced funding for most state agencies and departments by 4% this year, 5% in 2027, which the fiscal year actually starts in July. And now that was a whole series of bills, so we can't see how you would have fallen down on different bills. But one of the bills that affected the budgets of many agencies was House Bill 559. It conforms retroactively to the federal tax changes in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act that President Trump signed into law. How would you have voted on that particular bill? And then secondly, is an across-the-board cut of agencies the way to go about it, or should it be more selective?
Great question, Chris. So the answer is I would have supported incorporating the changes from the One Big Beautiful Bill into this year's tax impacts because it helps literally everyday Idahoans, and I want to help them as much as possible by reducing the tax burden. The problem is a spending problem. What's interesting is besides all the headlines about the budget cuts this year, we actually grew spending by 2.5% at the state level, and we still left $200 million surplus down on the bottom line, which we always do. It's considered our cushion just in case future tax revenues don't come in as expected.
Rainy day fund.
Yeah, well, no, different than that. We actually have $2 billion set aside in rainy day funds in about 10 different accounts. One of them is the biggest account that has over $1 billion. That's your cushion in case of a disaster. This is literally just saying, let's keep $200 million and not appropriate it just in case we need it for something that comes up next year without dipping into the savings accounts. The key is on the tax cut, on the cutting of spending. No, we should not do broad, let's cut everything. What happened is the legislature needed to dive more into Medicaid. Medicaid is the budget that's really growing every year. It's got a lot of improper payments and things of that nature, and they're not really carving it and diving into it and figuring out how to carefully trim that budget so they don't have to cut everything else. And so what they did was they cut everything else and didn't address the Medicaid problem. And it's the Medicaid problem that's creating an overall spending problem in years where we're still growing revenues, but budgets are a little, we don't get to grow them like 10% like we have over the last several years. And we have. We've grown spending at the state level 10 to 11% every year over the last several years. And we just didn't get to do that this year. We only got to grow it by 2.5%.
Okay. Well, we'll switch topics here a little bit and talk about your race with incumbent Senator Woodward. It's a repeat of actually the last few elections, I believe, for our District 1 Idaho Senate seat. And in 2024, your rematch was the most expensive race in the whole state. And each of you raised over $100,000. I don't have a breakdown, but I know a lot of that money came from Idaho residents, but there were some outside groups that contributed to both campaigns. How do you respond to voters who might say, hey, taking a bunch of money from special interest groups is going to make you beholden to those groups?
Great question. It was actually the most expensive campaign in 2022 as well. We get the pleasure of having hundreds of thousands of dollars spent up here in District 1. Now, the reality is, if I haven't looked at Jim Woodward's numbers as closely as I know mine, and 95% of my donors are actually individual donors in Idaho. 75% of them right now are right up here in District 1, Boundary and Bonner counties. And so these are regular Idahoans. When I say 95%, I mean of the total dollar amount. I have a few out-of-state donors. One of them is my mom. One of them is my dad. That's just an example of out-of-state donors. So this year, I haven't taken any money from political action committees at all. Now, what we can't control is we can't control when other groups decide to spend money. And so, for example, if the Realtors PAC, which is based out of Boise, decides to send out a text message in mail, those are called independent expenditures because they're not coordinated with the candidate. And I don't get to say whether they do that or don't do that. And it's happening on both sides of this race. There are out-of-the-area groups, usually based in Boise, sometimes with money that comes from out-of-state, and they spend money in this race. It's happening all over Idaho. It happens at a much greater rate in every other state. There is definitely no obligation encumbered upon me if some group spends money, because I usually don't even know they're spending it. I don't know ahead of time that they're going to do that. I don't know what they're going to do. I don't know how much they're going to do. And when I was in office, I was never asked to do anything except by the lobbyists at the Capitol, which is a really big group of 400 people that are there every day trying to get they work for corporations and special interests, and they try to get their bills passed. And usually I answer to the people of District 1, and I call up here and see what people up here want. Now, I don't answer to the lobbyists. Mm-hmm.
Raising a little question, because we're getting a lot of stuff in the mail, and some of that is from groups that aren't officially connected to your campaign. Is this stuff going out that doesn't represent you, that appears to be, you know, in favor of you?
So I haven't seen anything yet this year. So I'm only in charge of my own campaign messaging, and right, which I'm very active on social media.
And folks should be aware that people do, you get stuff in the mail that are from political action committees that could say anything, basically.
Yeah, they can say whatever they want. I don't necessarily always think they're doing the best messaging. Sometimes it's pretty solid. Like I say, there's not much I can do about it. Sometimes they're effective and sometimes they're not. I can tell you during the last campaign, a lot of them attacked me and my record and had completely false information about my record. So there doesn't seem to be necessarily scruples on that equation in every case. I'm very careful when, especially this year, campaigning to make sure I'm just reporting a voting record. I never go after an opponent on any personal issue or personal disagreement. It's always about what is the difference in our perspective on government and how do we vote differently on the big bills that affect Idahoans.
Okay, well, let's along these lines, one more question here. The Idaho Freedom Foundation is a statewide conservative lobbying organization that appears to have a lot of influence with legislators down in Boise, works with individual legislators to write and introduce bills. And they give a score on legislators. You had a 96% score from the IFF as a senator, meaning you voting in favor of legislation that supports 96% of the time, I surmise. So I think a question for some voters is whether the IFF has gained too much sway in the legislature and is telling lawmakers how they should vote. You know, what's your take on that? And, you know, more generally, do you believe a legislator's primary loyalty should be to an ideological scorecard or to a consensus of their local constituents?
So Idaho Freedom Foundation is a 501c3 think tank, is what they call themselves, a policy think tank. They're not the only ones in Boise. So this is things that people should really understand. There are literally 400 paid lobbyists that are at the Capitol every day. They wear green badges, and we literally get a book when we're in the Senate called Legislative Advisors, and it has all their names. And they have an expectation that if you're going to write a bill on a subject that impacts their clients, that you are going to talk to them. Now, IACI, which is the Idaho Association of Commerce and Industry, also has a legislative scorecard. And then all of the food producers also have a legislative scorecard. So you end up with all these legislative scorecards. And what I would say is, I look at any of those scorecards because they'll give them to us. Sometimes we're on the Senate floor and they'll give us the rating of a bill from IACI or the food producers. And you look at it, you look at the bill, and you decide as a legislator whether you agree with their analysis or not. And I do the same thing with Idaho Freedom Foundation. If they give me a bill analysis, which they don't actually hand me one, but literally we get handed bill analyses from these different groups.
Lobbyists.
Yeah, Idaho Sheriff's Association, Fraternal Order of Police, they literally all do this. Mm-hmm. And then you look at it and you say, am I in agreement with them? And a lot of times I'll call local people up here and ask what their opinion is. I've talked to our sheriff before about a bill, and I usually get local opinion, and then I just see if their analysis brings into light anything that actually is legitimate and whether I agree with it or not. I never look at the score and target my score.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's switch to a different topic here on education funding and school choice. So the legislature last year approved tax credits for private education that homeschoolers or people that want to put their kids in private schools could utilize. How do you balance the desire for this parental choice in education with our constitutional mandate to maintain a uniform public school system? It's actually part of the Constitution. And specifically, as relates to that, would you support diverting public funds to private or home schools if that means less funding for local rural school districts?
So the constitutional mandate I take very seriously. Right now, Idaho funds 79% of the public schools at the state level, and the remaining 21% is funded by local levies. And my property tax elimination program, that objective that I have, which is like a 10-year objective, I would eliminate the dependence on property taxes and local levies and shift to 100% funding from state government. However, I do want to point out that when it comes to accountability, we give the money to the public schools regardless of the academic performance. And right now, students are performing on average under 40% math proficiency at eighth grade and under 40% reading proficiency at grade level in eighth grade. And in my opinion, we need to do a lot better. And increasing the spending does not change scores, because some states spend 2.5 times per student more than we do and have no better performance. So when we talk about accountability, I want accountability for academic outcomes. Now, as far as this other money, parental choice tax credit, that is an important piece, in my opinion, to help kids get educated. The constitutional mandate is that we want educated children in the state of Idaho. And one size system doesn't fit everybody. And so I look at that as a legitimate option. It doesn't take money from the public schools budget. We've grown the public schools budget significantly over the last 10 years. And this was money that came from the general fund that you could argue could have been used to fix potholes in the road. It could have been used for one of the 180 other boards and agencies in Idaho government. The launch program I have a bigger problem with, which is post-secondary, it's for after high school graduation. It also goes to private schools, private religious universities and schools. And I wouldn't have prioritized, in fact, I voted against it, because I would have kept that $80 million, which came from House Bill 1 in 2022, was supposed to go to K-12 public education, and was diverted away from K-12 public education. The launch program legitimately is the one program that took $80 million that was targeted for K-12 and sent it somewhere else. And that program expires in 2028, and I would not vote to renew that program.
I think that was a program that the governor put forward, if I recall correctly.
Exactly.
Okay, well, let's ask a question about local control versus state mandates. And we had some legislation that passed this year down the legislature that kind of exemplify this. One was House Bill 561, which calls for a $2,000 per day fine for government entities that fly unapproved flags on government property. Of course, this affected Bonner's Ferry because the city up there flies a Canadian flag due to the historic ties and, you know, proximity to Canada. They get to do a lot of commerce there in Bonner's Ferry with Canadians. Now, the bill was amended so that Bonner's Ferry does get to fly the Canadian flag, but it's going to require others, entities like Boise, they fly an LGBTQ pride flag. They can't do that anymore. I don't know what other local entities might have flags that they have been flying historically. So this raises a question. When a controversial issue arises in our local community, such as flags or library content or facility usage, should the solution be crafted by local boards and residents, or should the state legislature be passing uniform laws that mandate how all Idaho communities have to handle these sorts of local control issues?
And the big answer is it depends. So, and a great example, we'll take firearms as an example. So we have a constitutional right to keep and bear arms. It's in the Idaho Constitution, it's in the federal Constitution. And we certainly wouldn't want to allow local cities to abridge that right, because then Idahoans, as they travel from city to city, may not get to fully enjoy their constitutional rights. And so in that case, you definitely want the state legislature to exercise what's called preemption. Now, it's also appropriate to exercise preemption because the way our Constitution is designed is the people have the power, we grant it to our state legislature, and the state legislature grants authority back to local government. That's the route of power here in Idaho. In other states, it grants it to local government and then state government. But we're the opposite. We grant to state, the state grants back to local. So we have to understand the structure, and the structure is that it's completely legitimate. Like, cities would not even exist had the Idaho legislature not created Idaho code that allows municipal corporations to exist. So it's entirely appropriate for the Idaho legislature, because they granted authority for municipal corporations to exist, to tell municipal corporations which flags they can fly. And I would say that this only came up because Boise was alienating a large part of their population. Now, it also shows you can't really solve the problem, because the legislature has now said, well, don't fly the LGBTQ rainbow flag, and now Boise's wrapped the flagpoles with stickers. So it just shows that these kind of culture wars really don't get solved through this type of legislation. But the argument that they were made, that Mayor McLean and Boise was making, is that we're trying to be inclusive. But the reality is a lot of their residents felt it was exclusive. And so the legislature just said, look, if you're a governmental entity, let's just fly government flags because they represent everybody in that governmental jurisdiction. And I think that was reasonable. I also appreciate that they went through the legal process to get an amendment to House Bill 561 to allow the Canadian flag to fly. My only issue has ever been, whatever the law is, let's all follow the law. And if we don't like the law, then let's get the law changed. Let's not just disobey the law.
Well, we're down to just a couple minutes now. Started our timer a little bit late. Let's squeeze in one or two more questions if we can. So House Bill 913, which was approved this legislative session, calls for the state to implement work requirements for adults enrolled in Medicaid expansion in order to receive those benefits. How would you have voted on that one?
We'll do lightning round on this a little bit, Chris, sure. So we can get to a couple. I would have voted in favor. I think it's reasonable that Medicaid expansion is able-bodied working individuals, and I think it's reasonable to have work requirements.
Okay, House Bill 583, it restricts local government's ability to impose rules that single out short-term rentals for additional requirements. That affected Sandpoint because they had a limit on the number of short-term rentals out of concern to provide housing for our local workforce. How would you have voted on that one?
I probably would have supported it. However, I do favor LUPA and cities and counties' ability to control their own land use. But I also want to favor people's private property rights. I probably would have voted for that one, but I think this is a very careful area to always keep an eye on.
Okay, we'll squeeze in one more here. House Bill, and these are all bills, even though you're in the Senate, these are bills that came before the Senate. They started with the House. House Bill 752 makes it a crime for people who knowingly and willfully enter a bathroom, locker room, shower room, changing room that's designed for the opposite biological sex. And of course, that was an issue here at the YMCA. How would you have voted on that one?
So that bill was my idea. So this is a problem that's happened for years. House Bill 752 was crafted because at the Sandpoint YMCA, Jenny Hook, the lifeguard, found a male in the women's locker room, and the YMCA policy was to allow that man to be in the women's locker room.
A transgender individual, yeah.
Yeah, well, it was a man, biological male, showering with girls in the locker room. And so I support criminal penalties, and I think that's going to finally end the problem. Interestingly enough, Jim Woodward voted for it, but he said he did not support the criminal penalties, the punitive measures. And I think absolutely that's in the same line with indecent exposure and Peeping Tom laws, and it's appropriate for it to be a crime.
Scott Herndon, candidate for Idaho Senate. We are out of time. How can people get in touch with you if they want to find out more about your campaign?
Number one, I'm very active on social media. It's Scott Herndon for Idaho. And I answer
Facebook, I presume.
Facebook, yeah. Yes. And I answer every comment, and I put up a couple posts a day. Also on X, I'm there at Herndon for Idaho. Text message 208-610-2680. People can call me at that same number. And I have a website, herndonforidaho.com. And I will literally answer anybody's question. If you want to message me on Messenger on Facebook, however you want to reach out to me, I'm available.
Scott Herndon, thanks for taking time to speak with us.
Thanks for your time, Chris. Thanks.